utter stupidity on our part. We thought it would work, we believed it would work, but, you know, in thinking back now, we were young and stupid. So it's stupidity and blind luck, but you need that in this game.
There will always be underground kinds of things that come along, and in a sense, Triumph was just kind of this people's kind of underground kind of thing. Hi, this is Rick Emmett.
Hi, this is Mike Levine from Triumph, and I'm in the studio for Just a Game and Allied Forces.
This is Gil Moore from Triumph, and you're in the studio for the Triumph Remasters.
When Toronto natives Rick Emmett, Mike Levine, and Gil Moore first got together as Triumph back in 1975, they subscribed to the philosophy that rock music played live should include a show. Because, after all, when it comes to performing live music, it's the music part is only half of it. The visual aspect, they believed, would be just as crucial to their eventual success. As a result, it was their live shows that quickly gave Triumph a name on the concert circuit north of the border. But that began to change in 1979 with the album Just a Game, Triumph's second American release. With its emphasis on Rick Emmett's melodic guitar sound and abundance of musical textures and layerings, the album Just a Game fit nicely into the void created by the emergence of punk, new wave, and disco in the late 1970s. But a year earlier, how did this trio, unknown outside their native Canada and initially without even a U.S. record deal, how did Triumph dare to headline their first American tour? Triumph co-founder, bass player Mike Levine is refreshingly frank.
Pure and utter stupidity on our part. We were so naive and so set in our ways that we thought we could do it. And it worked. It's just like pure unadulterated luck as far as I'm concerned. You know, we thought it would work. We believed it would work. But, you know, in thinking back now, we were young and stupid to even try it. It just happened to succeed, you know? Like, it didn't work the first time. All the shows lost money, but at least we got to play in front of people that probably 90% of them were converted to fans because they had either never seen us play and certainly had never heard our records on the radio at that point in time. So, you know, it's stupidity and blind luck, but you need that in this game.
Music holds the secret. To know it can make you whole. It's not just a game of notes, it's the sounds inside your soul. The magic of a melody runs through you like a stream. The notes that play flow through your head like a dream. Sing this song for the common man and for the people in despair. Bring my song into the world and I sing it everywhere. The simple truth lies waiting here for everyone to share. So hold on, and I will take you there.
Hold on to your dreams. Hold on.
Triumph guitarist Rick Emmett on lead vocal with Hold On from the 1979 breakthrough album Just a Game. From the start, Triumph was conceived specifically as a trio, according to co-founder, drummer, vocalist Gil Moore.
We came up with the idea for a three-piece band between Mike and myself before Rick was in the band. And we went out looking for a particular type of guitar player. Like, he had to sing. That was a given. And he had to be a good front man. Couldn't be somebody that wanted to stand at a microphone and, you know, close his eyes and sing, because we had a sort of a vision for a visually dynamic band. So Mike and I knew who we were looking for. So by the time we got Rick, this concept was pretty well developed as to what Triumph was going to be. And the limitation of the three-piece band was offset by the fact that Mike and I both played in bands. Mike had larger bands than I did, but, you know, my bands were always five or six members. Mike had bands with horns that were, you know, up to 10 members. And we were both fed up with the notion of having so many opinions. And you're always in a process of, you know, one guy's getting kicked out of the band. It's like a perpetual thing that the exit door is there for one guy. And then once he's gone, then there's who's the new guy that everybody can't stand, and let's get rid of him. So we were both fed up with that. The idea was really practical that we only wanted three musicians. We thought there's never going to be a tie vote.
that sounds
crazy, but that was part of it.
Yeah.
The whole idea about what we wanted to do musically, we were looking at, you know, bands like ZZ Top and Cream and, you know, Zeppelin for that matter.
Hendrix,
you know, again, you know, you were generally dealing with no rhythm guitar and no keyboards. So that was part of the philosophy about what we wanted to do musically. But we knew the limitations. We knew you know, I always said that in a three-piece band, there's nowhere to hide.
Like Kiss, Triumph subscribed to the same philosophy to putting on a show. But there was a definite learning curve to using flame-throwing pyrotechnic effects in their nightclub days in Toronto, according to Mike Levine and Gil Moore.
This is very early in our career, and we didn't have a lot of money, and this was a big payday for us. The bar sold out. There was a cover charge. There was maybe 1,000 people in the place. So our roadie talent wasn't exactly the best, and the pyro guy had put the torch on the front of the stage right below a sprinkler head. So when the torch went off, so did the sprinklers. The whole place.
Did you ever see the Poseidon Adventure? Picture Shelley Winters swimming.
They're swimming through. So we're in the dressing room, wet, and going, how are we just blew it? Like, we're not going to get paid. We're not going to be able to make our, you know, the rental payments. We're not going to, you know, Ernie's not going to pay us.
His hoods are going to come and kill us.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because he was a little bit connected. So we're in the dressing room and we're cowering. We get to a phone and we phone our agent. Phoned Ralph. I think Ralph was the agent. Ralph Jolivet. Ralph, we just messed up badly. The club is underwater. we didn't play more than one song. How are we going to get paid? He goes, leave it with me. I'll get back to you. But 10 minutes later, Ernie comes in the dressing room with a bottle of scotch, and he goes, that's the best thing that ever happened to this club. This is unbelievable. I'm so happy. And we're sitting there scratching our heads going, what the hell's wrong with Ernie?
Yeah, we drank scotch with him. He loved it.
He loved it. He paid us.
Yeah.
He just thought that, you know, the fact that, you know, a big sold-out show and the sprinkler goes off was great publicity for him somehow. I don't know.
It was like one of the natural disasters of the world that happened right in his club. He thought it was like prime time.
Yeah.
Even after their second Canadian album, Rock and Roll Machine, in 1978, the members of Triumph had to face the fact that there's really only a dozen cities to play there, but spread out in an area as large as the U.S. And any band ended up spending all their money just hauling their gear and personnel to these far-flung locales. According to guitarist singer Rick Emmett, Triumph gambled big time on their dream by setting their sights on the U.S.
We put together our own PA and lights company. And we went to the bank and we borrowed, you know, I don't know, it was a lot of money, a couple of hundred grand, put together this equipment. And then we went to the promoters in the States and we said, look, you know, obviously we can't expect you to pay us a big guarantee. And in fact, don't worry about the guarantee, but we won't have to hire out sound and lights. We're bringing our own sound and lights. So pay us, you know, a couple of grand for sound and lights. So we survived on that. We actually even were able to make some money. We got paychecks and stuff to be out on the road playing. And we'd play a small theater. We wouldn't draw a lot of people, but we'd put on a big show. There would be this big extravaganza. And I mean, you know, in those days, our flash pots were, you know, we were wiring things together and using bubble gum to stick things together. And, you know, I mean, it was like just whatever we could do, but it looked big time and there was lots of lights and lots of special effects and stuff. And so whoever did come and see the band would go away saying, wow, I can't wait for those guys to come back. Wait till you see their show. Then the next time we'd come back, we would do well and we'd sell lots of tickets. And so then we were established as a concert headliner in the market. By only playing twice, but we'd headline both times.
Drummer Gil Moore says that Triumph got a surprising reaction to their bold move from both sides of the border.
The way I saw things when we crossed the border, we got welcomed with open arms in the United States. Up here, it was a little more, you know, why do you guys think you're so special? You know, you're only, you know, local guys or whatever. There's that thing where you eat your young. It was this. It was the certification of the U.S. of A. that really made things turn around in Canada. What up here, it was kind of like scratch your head. Well, why do you think you're doing this? Whereas we came to the United States, and it was, and I'm talking all the states that we initially went to. It was more of a wow, you guys really got balls. This is amazing. You guys are really going to do this, aren't you? And it was more of a wide-eyed expectation. So it was, for us, really refreshing not to be kind of second-guessed. Mike's point about, you know, how naive we were, I would agree with that. I mean, we were really, you know, it's like being an explorer looking for a new country 200 years ago, trying to figure out if the world is flat. And it's like, is this rock and roll machine going to fly or not? But fortunately, you know, the U.S. of A. kind of welcomed us with open arms. Starting right in the state of Texas, that's where it all started.
And in true rock and roll underdog tradition, it turns out that Triumph's detractors actually motivated the band as much as their increasing album and ticket sales did. Again, ex-Triumph singer-guitarist Rick Emmett.
And we felt that what we had was good, and we weren't going to let critics or radio programmers or people in positions of power and authority who think they know better, but, you know, maybe they don't sometimes, and everybody's just human, you know. And if we could just get a chance to get to people with it, get directly to people with it, that would be enough, that the word of mouth would be enough. And there was no other way. And there's always that. That will always happen. There will always be underground kinds of things that come along. And in a sense, Triumph was just kind of this people's kind of underground kind of thing.
It's the same old story all over again. You turn a lover into just another friend. Games. I'm tired of
waste my time.
From 1979's Triumph album Just a Game, their third overall, that's Lay It on the Line with great remastered sound. Next, Mike Levine, Gil Moore, and Rick Emmett reveal what a eunuch is. Plus, we'll hear the magic power as Triumph continues their good fight towards stardom. I'm Redbeard, in the studio for the Triumph Remasters. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and of course a whole lot more here at InTheStudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Triumph's Rick Emmett, Gil Moore, and Mike Levine. A breakthrough, Just a Game.
Hi, this is Rick Emmett.
Hi, this is Mike Levine from Triumph, and I'm in the studio for Just a Game and Allied Forces.
This is Gil Moore from Triumph, and you're in the studio for the Triumph Remasters.
And I'm Redbeard. Having the will to leave Toronto and a plan to tour the U.S. as a first-time headliner was one thing. The reality of such a bold endeavor was another thing entirely, according to first Triumph drummer Gil Moore and bass player Mike Levine.
Very first tour we went over, we didn't have real tour buses. We had these things called eunuchs. And these eunuch was basically, like a made-in-China motorhome. You know, before China made motorhomes. And it was like, I think we were on our way to the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh when the motor fell out of the first one. We had two of them. You remember that, Mike?
I sure do.
Oh, man. And, they sent a replacement eunuch down, and we got that baby going. And then I think we were on our way to Cincinnati or something the next day, and kaboom, the engine went in the other way. Finally, the company said, we don't want to rent you guys motorhomes anymore.
I think we had a tow truck following us around just so we could make it to gigs.
Something's at the edge of your mind. You don't know what it is. Something you were hoping to find. You're not sure what it is. Then you hear the music and it all comes crystal clear. Does the talking, says the things you ought to hear. I'm young, I'm wild, I'm free.
Triumph, million-plus seller, Allied Forces in 1981. That's Magic Power, written and sung by Rick Emmett. Triumph was the third Canadian band in the 70s to parlay their debut on a tiny independent label into eventual stardom. Rush, also from Toronto, did it first, followed by Vancouver's Heart, and finally Triumph. Drummer-singer Gil Moore has a theory.
I don't know. I think the cold climate's an interesting philosophy. We were talking about that here in the studio last week. I'm not kidding. I'm dead serious about the cold weather forces you to stay indoors, and that the best time to create is when you don't want to go outside. So as opposed to Canadian summers or falls or springs, we're talking Canadian winters. So all three of those bands shared that. And it'd be interesting to go back and trace how much of their time they actually spent in the recording studio or in the songwriting phase during the cold months. But it was Tom Cochran, actually, that I was talking to about it. And he said, you know, think about it, Gilly. He said, you like to sit around and play your guitar. It's cold outside. You can be creative inside. Kind of keeps you warm. It's a way to, you know, deal with the weather and feel like you're accomplishing something. So it's the best time to create.
And with Triumph's Allied Forces album, guitarist-vocalist Rick Emmett saw the opportunity for Triumph to elevate their game.
I was trying to say, look, even though I play this hard rock stuff and we play arenas and stuff, this is not just, the industry has a way of saying, look, you make music for the male demographic of 16 to 24. And I wanted to say, no, wait a sec, you know, rock music is as valid as any other type of music, and it can talk to all kinds of people. So there was a sort of a conscientious attempt to say, look, this music is for women, and this song is for kids, and this music can be for older people too, you know.
An indicator as to just how personal lyric writing became for Rick Emmett is the fact that the real-life inspiration for the song Fight the Good Fight was kept secret, even from his bandmates. Emmett never revealed that his aunt's battle with terminal cancer informed those lyrics, according to Triumph drummer Gil Moore.
He may have kept it to himself because Rick and I argued quite a bit about the lyrics in that song. And, over the course of time, most of my objections, if not all, I've withdrawn. Let's put it that way. I like the song a lot more now than I did when it was written. I can't explain that. You know, because I know at the time Rick was about ready to pull his hair out with me because he would come to rehearsal and say, well, if you don't like it, then fix it yourself. So I wouldn't fix it. He ended up, you know, working his way through my objections. But the final change in the song was when the chorus was actually written because the song was called Every Moment before that. So Fight the Good Fight, because I came up with the first few ideas, you know, you tend to feel more responsible for the song than if it's somebody else's idea. But Rick wrote all the lyrics, so maybe I felt like I had a right to nitpick the lyrics more than I would have otherwise, but he was about ready to deck me. Kind of never really gave him a slap on the back that I probably should have. But the passage of time and listening to the lyrics and, you know, how he delivered them and so on, I thought it was a great vocal performance, and it's a song that I'm proud of.
I do my best to
Another top 15 song from Triumph's 1981 platinum album, Allied Forces, that's Fight the Good Fight, inspired by singer-guitarist Rick Emmett's aunt and her unfailing spirit, even while dying from cancer. Up next, Triumph is invited to play at an intimate gathering of a half million. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with the Triumph Remasters.
Hi, this is Rick Emmett.
Hi, this is Mike Levine from Triumph, and I'm in the studio for Just a Game and Allied Forces.
This is Gil Moore from Triumph, and you're in the studio for the Triumph Remasters.
And I'm Redbeard. With the platinum sales of Triumph's Allied Forces album, the Toronto Trio could sell out the largest North American arenas. However, the success did little to mollify their critics, but it certainly made the band's hide a lot tougher. Here's former Triumph singer-guitarist Rick Emmett.
We were never a darling of the critics. We were what you'd call your get out a large stick and whoop that thing, you know. We were the horse that everyone flogged. I don't know. I don't want to make, you know, sweeping generalizations. We'd get nice reviews here and there, but I guess overall, it was not a critics band. We didn't make the kind of music that critics like, you know. I can understand that. And it didn't, you know, it bothered me a lot initially. But then I realized that, you know, that's just the way it goes, that there's going to be some people that can just do no wrong. And, you know, and critics will always love them. And then there's guys that can just do no right, you know. So we'd get to the point where we'd even joke and laugh about it. You know, there was once on a review in Rolling Stone that called us a mutant, a Vegas pit band of mutant hose heads. That's what they called us. So, but, you know, in the end, it was just funny. You know, then we'd do an interview and people would say, well, how do you describe the Triumph sound? And we go, well, it's kind of like a bunch of mutant hose heads, a Vegas pit band, you know.
distinct white reggae feel on the verses, popularized then by bands such as The Police and The Payolas. That's the title song from Triumph's 1983 album, Never Surrender. Triumph was invited that summer to play the second US Festival in California, put on by Apple Computer co-founder Steve Wozniak. Triumph's US Festival performance is now available on DVD in 5.1 surround sound, according to Gil Moore and Mike Levine.
And the lineup that day, they had Van Halen, they had Judas Priest, Motley Crue, Ozzy Osbourne, Scorpions, US, of course, and it was a dream for anybody that was into rock music at that time. And the Clash got a lot of ink by, you know, bad mouthing Apple as a corporation and bad mouthing Steve as being a corporate guy, but they were really, you know, it was pretty transparent. They were just trying to grab some media attention for themselves for their own commercial purposes. I mean, they were really the ones trying to exploit Steve. It wasn't the other way around, and I thought that was ironic. The festival itself was tremendously successful. They had great weather. They had a phenomenal lineup over three nights. The stage was so big that it was hard to play on. You almost felt like you were playing in different area codes, you know, between the musicians.
There was this one camera that was on a remote control that just kept flying around the stage, and I kept bumping into it all the time.
It was just a very, very odd dynamic on stage because it was something you were never used to, but it was absolutely, you know, your jaw just dropped, your knees would buckle. It was just gigantic.
On another DVD entitled A Night of Triumph Live, I was really impressed to see Gil Moore drumming with all four limbs while simultaneously singing lead vocal.
It's a bit like being a plumber and an electrician simultaneously. Sooner or later, you're going to have your hand on the hot wire and grab one of the pipes that's grounded and electrocute yourself. It's really a no-win career. For all the kids out there, don't even think about it.
See, now, can we change topics? Because Gil's head's starting to get swollen now. We used to have to tell, he used to complain how hard it was, and we say, no, it's easy. You know, anybody can do that.
Beard, let's stick with this topic, okay? We're onto something here. Let me tell you, Beard, I told Mike and Rick for years that I was the hardest working man in show business, and you've identified this fact. I'm glad to see this is coming to the forefront. You know, I agree with you. That camera angle, we call that the appendix cam.
You know, I have to leave now and get coffee.
That baby is shot. That baby was aimed at my third rib.
Always the showman. Triumph had by this time incorporated laser light technology into their stage show. I asked what considerations they made in their never-ending quest to entertain fans. Mike Levine, followed by Gil Moore.
Blindness was our first concern. and radiation levels. Well, with a laser, unless it's refracted, basically hitting a mirror before it hits you, it could be quite dangerous. And even after it's refracted, it's possibly dangerous too.
Our laser tech used to do a little demonstration where he smoked cigarettes, so he never used a cigarette lighter, right? He would just reach his hand over and put his cigarette in the laser, and the laser would light it like bang. We had a set of sticks that lit up that were, each stick was like a beam of laser. So I had to be very friendly with this guy because he was right behind me and he had all this equipment. And I always thought if I pissed him off, I might get a colonoscopy out of the laser, you know. So we had to be on the best of terms, Beard.
Our entire show, our road crew had to love us. Otherwise, they could have killed us easily.
Oh, yeah, they could have killed us anytime.
The laser guy, the pyro guy, the lighting guys.
The worst danger for me was really my own drum tech, Mikey, because he had the controls to my riser, which would go, it had treads on it like an army tank, so it would go forwards, backwards, it could turn, it could pivot, and it could also jack me up about 15 feet in the air. So if I caught him on a bad day, he could do some serious damage to me quickly. Yeah, he could have just driven me right off the front of the stage and said, you know, to hell with you.
That would have been great.
Originally released in 1986 on the Triumph album The Sport of Kings, that's Tears in the Rain, now available as part of the Triumph Remaster Series. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this.